violations, war crimes in Yemen, and the criminal oppression of migrant workers.
BDS urges to boycott political, cultural, sporting initiatives used by Tel Aviv to show that Israel is a country where peace and harmony rule and there is no system of oppression against Palestinians.
The Dubai Expo has been awash in controversy since day one, with the European Parliament urging nations not to take part in the initiative. The legislative branch of the EU has cited human rights abuses, the jailing of activists, and the autocratic government's use of spyware to target critics.
EU Parliament's calls to withdraw from Dubai Expo 2020 also included the main sponsor of the initiative. According to Palestinian citizens residing in Italy, the EU could take a much firmer stance towards holding the UAE government accountable for its ongoing systematic oppression of Palestinians and its utter disregard to international law.
The EU should boycott Israel in the first place. If Brussels really believes that the Expo has to be boycotted, it should say it more clearly. The EU always has a double standard when it comes to the Arab world.
The Dubai Expo takes place against a backdrop of a growing UAE-Israel military security alliance, starting with Abu Dhabi's import of billions of dollars worth of Israeli security and military technology in recent years. Max Civili, Rome.
Barricaded and heavily guarded, the show forced by the local government against peaceful protesters who want to present a memorandum at U.S. Consulate for the release of Pakistani neuroscientist Dr. Afia Siddiqui, who was kidnapped along with her three children by the FBI agent with the assistance of the local secret services. Protesters are outraged over what they call the Khan administration's failure to stand by its promise to bring Dr. Afia home. She had been sentenced to 86 years in prison by the U.S. Afia protests coincided with the arrival of U.S. Deputy Secretary Wendy Sherman and her seven-member delegation exempted from the COVID-19 rapid antigen test and body scanning on arrival.
Our establishment is so in awe, it's awe-stricken with America, that it won't even let a peaceful delegation go to this, to just send a memorandum, that's all. It goes to show that the Tehreek-e-Insaf establishment has nothing to do with Insaf.
Heavy contingent of police was deployed to stop the march miles away from the U.S. consulate.
This is a peaceful demonstration. We just want to go to the American consulate. We just want to submit a memorandum in which it is written that Afia is innocent. The war is over. The American forces have flown back. We have given safe passage. 5,000 Americans and NATO soldiers in negotiation. We can't even bring our daughter back.
Later, two members of the protest were allowed to submit their memorandum.
This is just for the security purpose. We have stopped them here. And now a small contingent of their is moving towards the consulate to present a memorandum of the protest to the consulate.
Although U.S. war in Afghanistan is over, but with broken promises by repeated Pakistani governments, Afia's family doesn't seem that lucky. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue our discussion of Imam Khomeini's views on different issues. In today's program, you'll be listening to his advice on the authorities and students of seminaries. Please stay with us. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, had explicated his views on seminaries and presented necessary warnings on the issue during his lifetime. However, this issue is the most important message to the seminaries and to religious scholars at ulama in the waning months of the Imam's life. In his message, the Imam called the ulama or religious scholars as the carriers and trustees of revelation, which they should strive to guide the people through the content of revelation and what has been bequeathed to us from the Prophet of Islam and his infallible progeny, blessings of God upon them. He writes in his message, "There is no doubt that the seminaries and the committed ulama throughout the history of Islam and Shi'ism have been the most important bastion of Islam against assaults and deviations. The great religious scholars or ulama of Islam have tried through their lifetimes to promote the issues of divine haram or forbidden laws and halal or permitted laws without modification. Had there not been the dear jurisprudence, it was not clear what sciences would have been sold to the masses in the name of sciences of the Quran, Islam, and Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. The collection and preservation of the sciences of the Holy Quran and Islam, and the works and hadith of the great Prophet, and the practices and behavior of the infallible Imams, peace be upon them, and the registration, compilation, and explication of them under the conditions that there were very little facilities and the rulers and oppressors had employed all their facilities to destroy the works of prophethood was not an easy job. Yet, thank God, today we can see the result of those efforts in the works and books such as Kutub-e Arba'eh, the four main books of Shia seminaries, and other books of the previous and future generations in the fields of jurisprudence, philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, principles of jurisprudence, hadith, history of Islam, exegesis of the Holy Quran, literature, Irfan or Gnosticism, lexicon, and all various fields of sciences. If we do not call this much effort as jihad in the way of God, then what shall we call it?" Imam Khomeini continues in his message for ulama and the seminaries. "As for the scientific services of seminaries, there is too much to say to the extent that it goes beyond the scope of what can be mentioned here. Thank God the seminaries are rich and innovative from the viewpoint of sources and methods of discussion and ijtihad or independent reasoning on the basis of the Holy Quran and Hadith. I do not think that there can be found a more proper way for deep and comprehensive examination of Islamic sciences than the methods of the preceding ulama. Over 1,000 years of history of research and erudition of true ulama or religious scholars of Islam bears testimony to this claim. This has nurtured the sapling of Islam to flourish. For hundreds of years, the clergy of Islam have been the support of the deprived. The downtrodden have always been satiated by the pure kosar of the teachings of great jurisprudence. Apart from their scientific and cultural struggles, which are superior to the blood of martyrs in some aspects, in every age, they have suffered hardships and bitterness in defense of their religion and patriotic sanctities. And while suffering captivity, exile, prison, imprisonment, harassment, and taunts, they have offered precious martyrs to the divine court. The martyrs of the clergy are not restricted to the martyrs of struggles and the war in Iran. Certainly, the number of anonymous martyrs of seminaries and the clergy who have lost their lives in the path of spreading the divine teachings and divine laws in the hands of mercenaries is very large. In every divine and popular uprising and revolution, the ulama or religious scholars of Islam have been the first who have been martyred." prophet Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, continued by saying, "This does not mean that we defend all clergymen, and the dependent and sanctimonious clergy were not and are not small in number. There are people in seminaries who are active against pure Muhammadian Islam. Today, some people, through sanctimonious posture, are cutting the roots of religion, revolution, and the system in a way as if they had no other duty. The danger of this backwardness and regression is certainly not small. Dear students, should not neglect these colorful snakes for a single moment. These are the promoters of American Islam and the enemies of God's messengers." The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, points to two key methods that are used by enemies in seminaries. The Imam said, "Once the global arrogance was disappointed at complete destruction of the clergy and seminaries, it chose two ways to strike. One was intimidation and coercion, and the other way was deception and infiltration in the contemporary decades. When the weapon of intimidation and threatening was useless, the ways of infiltration was strengthened. The first and most important move was the insinuation of the slogan of separation of religion from politics, which has unfortunately worked to some extent in seminaries and among the clergy so that interference in politics is considered as inferior to the status of the jurisprudent, and entering the arena of politics will cause the accusation of dependence on foreigners. For sure, the struggling clergy have been suffering more from infiltration. Do not think that the accusation of dependence and calumny of irreligiousness have been applied against the clergy only by foreigners. This is not so. The blows of unaware and dependent, aware clergy have been much stronger than those of the foreigners." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, also addressed the clergy in his testimony. The Imam said, "I recommend to the seminaries, as I have repeatedly said, that in this era that the opponents of Islam and the Islamic Republic have attempted to topple Islam and try in every way to achieve this satanic goal, one of the important ways to this unholy and dangerous end is to infiltrate deviated and wicked persons in seminaries, whose great short-term danger is to scandalize the seminaries with indecent acts and deviated ethics and methods, and the very danger in long-term is to attain high positions by one or a few charlatans who ensconce themselves among the masses and strata of pure-hearted people and make them love them, and then deal a fatal blow to the Islamic seminaries and dear Islam and the country at the right moment." Dear listeners, in our next program, we shall continue our discussions today. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, non-conformity of belief with action. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most most beneficent, the most merciful. One of the major faults of man is non-conformity of his belief and actions. He says he believes in something, but no trace of that belief is observed in his actions. He believes in God, but he does not practice the discipline required in his daily life to make his deeds consistent with that belief. He believes in the great court of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but has not prepared himself to face it. He believes in Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam as the greatest prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam as the highest leader, but he does not demonstrate any similarity with them by his actions. In short, his belief points in one direction and his action in another. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, who's the fourth infallible Imam, has said, "The most hated people before Allah are those who have accepted the leadership of an Imam but do not follow his actions." Brothers and sisters, we need to try our best, our level best, to bring our actions in conformity with our beliefs. We believe in many things, many good things that Islam has provided us, but when it comes to practice, somehow our nafs or shaitan doesn't allow us to practice those beliefs. And belief without practice is of not much use. This is something we all need to know. This is something we all need to digest. Our iman and our belief has to be in line with our actions, and our actions have to be in line with our beliefs. This is when we can call ourselves to be a mu'min or a believer. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of non-conformity of belief with action. And we quoted for you the hadith of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, who is the fourth infallible Imam, who has expressed that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala dislikes those who take Imams as their role model but they do not follow, for instance. Now, the question is, how do we bring this conformity between our belief and action? Brothers and sisters, we need to know that it is definitely difficult for us to act on the divine commandments of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala because the way the world is laid out at the moment. But for those who, based on their belief, they have enough courage to follow the footsteps of Imams and follow the commandments of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they are the ones who become successful in both the worlds. Yes, the difficulty is there, we all realize that. But bringing these two in conformity with each other, it is something that has been desired and has been asked off of us. So make sure that we are walking on this path, at least, you know, trying our level best to bring our beliefs and actions together. Consolidating our actions with our beliefs is of utmost importance. Otherwise, the belief is of almost of no use, right? In some cases, as a matter of fact, if your actions are contradictory to your beliefs, you're going to have to pay a price for it in the hereafter. Because you knew what the right path was. You knew, in terms of your belief, you knew what you were supposed to do in a certain situation, but you failed to do it. Now there's retribution. Now there's punishment for it. So once we have something part of our belief, we need to make sure that our actions are in conformity with that belief. They need to reconcile, as much as we can. Yes, we all realize we are not ma'asum, we are not infallible, but at the same time, we have this realization that we can practice our beliefs the way Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala expects us to.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio,
Thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Britain grapples with a full-blown crisis. Labor shortages, truck drivers in particular, have disrupted supply chain activities and caused several problems. The significant lack of drivers meant deliveries of fuel and food were falling short. As a result, the country witnessed panic buying of fuel and some goods dwindled. These events triggered chaotic scenes across major cities, leading to long lines at gas stations and fistfights among drivers. Also, many factories and businesses are struggling with rising energy bills. They are on the verge of halting production and closing down unless the government immediately acts on spiraling natural gas prices. In fact, the crisis has already forced a wave of collapses among energy suppliers. This is while the government is planning to impose a levy on gas bills, which could push the prices further. The British government is now under fire for its handling of the crisis. So, being under intense pressure, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson blamed the trucking industry for Britain's supply chain mess. The industry called Johnson's claims wrong and pointed to the government's immigration policy and delays in testing and certifying new drivers as the main culprits. The government also claimed there is a global shortage of drivers. However, the European countries have not faced a similar problem. Britain faces a shortfall of 100,000 drivers. 20% of those are drivers who departed Britain after the country voted to leave the European Union. In addition, about 200,000 EU citizens left Britain during the coronavirus pandemic. So, how does the British government address the crisis? By introducing a short-term visa program. But by offering short-term visas to foreign truckers, the British government is admitting that exiting the EU was a decisive factor in the current crisis. In addition, many people are reluctant to uproot themselves and move to Britain for temporary and difficult work while they have better options in EU member state countries.
It's a crisis of the free market, a triumph of the free market. The government abandoned regulation, it abandoned public ownership, so it's private ownership. So we're depending for energy in Britain on people who make lots of profits out of energy shortages. So, you know, if it's to someone's advantage to see gas and electricity prices shoot up, then they're going to go up. They're not going to say, oh, we're not going to take profits because it's bad for the economy. They're going to say, hey, send me more.
Households that spend a high proportion of their income on energy bills are considered to be in fuel poverty. Currently, 4 million people in Britain are already in fuel poverty, while up to 1.5 additional British households won't be able to afford to heat and power their homes. Last October, the government raised the energy price cap to control the sharply rising wholesale gas prices. The cap limits the impact of soaring energy prices on British households. The UK energy regulator said that the price cap must rise again next year if wholesale gas prices continue to go up. This could mean a typical customer paying between £400 and £600 more annually. That's while natural gas prices are at record highs as economies around the world begin to recover from the COVID crisis.
The government in Britain has recently cut back on the minimum payments for welfare and support for all sorts of people, from unemployed to underpaid to pensioners. So a lot of the apparatus that was very leaky, the very leaky safety net we already had in Britain has been torn up, and the government has decided that people, as a matter of conscious policy, they think that people only go to work if they're starving, so they're trying to starve people, and that includes freezing them. Freezing and starving will get them to work is what they think.
The price rises have already pushed 500,000 more households into fuel poverty. Unable to pay heating and energy costs, these low-income families are at a great risk. Many actually die every year because they can't afford to heat their homes. In fact, 8,500 people died in England and Wales last winter due to cold homes. All in all, the British government should stop blaming others and start cleaning up the mess it is responsible for.
In another sign of growing tensions in ties between Washington and Beijing, the United States Central Intelligence Agency announced the formation of a group that would focus exclusively on China. The CIA argued in a statement that the China Mission Center aims at addressing what it called global challenges to the U.S. competitiveness posed by the People's Republic of China. According to the U.S. spy agency, those issues include emerging technologies, economic security, climate change, and health.
The real threat that China poses that the United States is referring to is the ability to undermine the empire. And when we see that right now, that there's definitely a global shift going on, which is starting to move from the West towards the East, of which China is the main power in this situation.
The announcement comes amid a wider prioritization by the administration of President Joe Biden on countering Beijing. In June, Biden announced a new task force at the Pentagon to assess and respond to Beijing's military challenge. The United States and China remain at odds over several issues, including the situation in Hong Kong, U.S. relations with Taiwan, trade, commerce, and a disputed South China Sea. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In the case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing. Top U.S. counterintelligence officials have reportedly warned that a concerning number of CIA informants are being captured and executed. According to the New York Times, the warning came in a top-secret memo the officials issued to all of the CIA stations and bases around the world last week. The memo suggests that the agency's counterintelligence mission center looked at dozens of cases in the last several years involving foreign informants who had been killed, arrested, or most likely compromised. The cable itself was not necessarily unique, but as the Times notes, announcing the specific number of killings is rare, as the information is usually kept strictly under wraps by intelligence officials.
And this has been something that was significant enough that it was leaked into the mainstream media where it was reported on. It seems the United States sees this as possibly a potential crisis and something they need to reinforce with more bodies.
According to the Times, recruiting spies has always been highly risky. However, the cable warned that the CIA has not excelled in the area recently for reasons that include being too trusting of sources, underestimating foreign intelligence agencies, and moving too quickly to recruit informants while ignoring potential risks.
It's frankly acknowledged that everybody is spying on everybody else because everybody needs to know what their competitor is doing with regards to their stance towards them and what plans they have, etc. So in this regard, the United States is not doing anything new, nothing that it has ever done before. But the main bulwark of this, the main reason this is happening, is the U.S. is trying to expand its current intelligence network.
The report says that the uptick in the compromised informants highlights the growing prowess of other countries in employing innovations like biometric scans, facial recognition, artificial intelligence, and hacking tools to track the movements of CIA officers in order to discover the sources. The memo suggested that the U.S. spy agency overestimated its capacities and underestimated its adversaries. The results show that countries targeted by U.S. espionage are becoming more capable of exposing agents than ever before.
U.S. social media giant has come under a scathing attack by a former employee. The company has been accused of putting profit over everything else. Former Facebook employee Frances Hogan says that the company's sites and apps are harmful for children. She's also accused the social media platform of stoking divisions in society. 37-year-old Hogan was previously a product manager at the company. Now she's a whistleblower and has turned against Facebook. She made the accusation at a hearing in the Senate. Hogan accused Facebook of putting profit over safety and compared it to tobacco companies, arguing that a company with such frightening influence over so many people, over their deepest thoughts, feelings, and behavior, needs real oversight. She also said that if left alone, Facebook will continue to make choices that go against the common good.
If you look at the way that they filter content, if you look at the way that they censor certain topics that they'd rather not be seen, the way that they quote-unquote fact-check some of the things, the way that they delete accounts without discretion, the way that they censor people, and the way that they choose what content goes at the top of your newsfeed or shows up on your newsfeed at all through their algorithm, they really have a grip on what it is we are able to see on Facebook.
The context for the hearing were materials that she had leaked to the Wall Street Journal. According to the documents, Facebook's own studies suggest that Instagram and social media in general have a negative psychological effect on young girls. She also accused Facebook's CEO Zuckerberg of having too much power and bringing up the January 6th Capitol riot.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. that you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal.
Facebook has faced growing scrutiny and increasing calls for its regulation. Founder Mark Zuckerberg hit back, saying the latest accusations were at odds with the company's goals. In a letter to the staff, he said that many of the claims were illogical and pointed to Facebook's efforts to fight harmful content. The CEO argued that while Facebook took the initiative to create a massive research project to identify and solve certain problems, critics are merely weaponizing that work against the company to create a false narrative. Responding to Hogan's claims that Facebook's attempts to limit harmful content were constantly hampered by a shortage of staff, he said, "If we did not care about fighting harmful content, then why would we employ so many more people dedicated to this than any other company in our space, even ones larger than us?" Facebook is the world's most popular social media site. The company says it has 2.7 billion monthly active users.
So I think overall it's very detrimental to democracy because of the flow of information that is so tightly controlled through Facebook. And also think it shows, much like tobacco companies in the past or vape companies, that they've targeted children who are in very crucial developmental stages in their lives in order to get new customers, as noted in the testimony before the Senate.
Hundreds of millions of people also use the company's other products, including WhatsApp and Instagram, but it has been criticized on several fronts, from failing to protect users' privacy to not doing enough to halt the spread of disinformation.
Facebook, as I said, can truly decide what shows up in your newsfeed, what gets attention, what is put in the spotlight, and what is suppressed. And I think that's a big problem. It doesn't matter who you're friends with or who you like or the groups you're in, etc. They can filter stuff out through including certain ads. They can bury stuff in their algorithms. They can ban or censor or suspend accounts that may or may not go against the terms of service. Sometimes it's not so clear whether or not certain users go against terms of service, but find themselves banned or suspended anyway.
The accusations against the social media giant came amid a worldwide outage of the company's platforms. The social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. The global outage and the revelations seriously harmed the media giant's status in the world as a reliable media platform.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, led by the United States, has long been on a confrontational course with Russia. Developments on the ground on Russia's western borders and elsewhere are pointing to increasing tensions between the two sides. The Western Alliance has been moving military hardware and ground forces to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. The situation in Ukraine has turned into another serious bone of contention. NATO and Russia have been flexing their military muscles. The two have shown through their military drills and deployments, as well as public statements, that they are serious about pursuing their geopolitical interests in the Baltic region, the Middle East, and even in the Arctic. Meanwhile, America's ongoing efforts to complete a comprehensive missile system in Europe have further worried Moscow. Radars, warships, and long-range missile interceptors placed across Europe form components of the controversial system.
Without the Soviet Union, NATO does not need to exist, and they are clinging for dear life. They're trying to justify, to create a reason for them to be there and to continue to exist, and that's why they're constantly provoking Russia when Russia is not the Soviet Union. They are not the threat that the Soviet Union was.
As NATO expands eastward, Russia is not sitting idly by. It has adopted a set of countermeasures. For instance, Russia has used its westernmost territory, Kaliningrad, as a platform to boost its defenses. The territory is located between Poland and Lithuania on the Baltic Sea. Moscow has deployed the Iskander missiles and its S-400 air defense systems in Kaliningrad. NATO and Moscow have maintained contacts to try to minimize risks. The Russian Federation has had an observer mission to the Western Alliance. It was meant to promote cooperation in common security areas. This week, tensions between the two sides escalated once again after NATO expelled some members of the Russian mission. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that the organization expelled the 8 Russian diplomats over a rise in, quote, malign activities by Moscow. The Russian government was quick to slam NATO's decision. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that there is an obvious inconsistency in statements by NATO representatives about their desire to normalize relations with Russia and in their actual actions. He added that such actions allow Moscow not to develop illusions about the normalization of relations. Meanwhile, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the lower house of the Russian parliament, Leonid Slutsky, warned of asymmetric retaliatory measures. How will this latest episode of tensions between the two sides play out? NATO's relations with Moscow have largely been tied to the policies of the United States. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was usually accused of being too soft on Russia, but Joe Biden has made it clear that his administration will be tough on Moscow. In his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed 2 new sets of sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden has repeated accusations of interference in U.S. elections and cyber attacks on government and businesses against Russia. Washington and Moscow are also locked in a dispute over embassy staffing, which could further sour their ties. Analysts believe that the rivalry between the Russian Federation and the West, including NATO, is too deep-rooted to be solved in any foreseeable future.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant.
Imamat yek asle zinda dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the book The Inner Voice, Allama Sayyid Said Akhtar Rizvi aptly explains the need for a man to understand his purpose in life and to be able to ponder over some of the important aspects of our journey in reaching nearness to Allah. Today, we will read to you an excerpt of this book. Stay with us. Sinlessness of Prophets. And we sent not an apostle, but to be obeyed according to the will of God. Quran chapter 4, verse 64. God sent so many prophets and apostles to lead their people on right path. Some of them were sent to a small group, others to large communities or countries. In the end, the Prophet of Islam was sent to the whole mankind. The prophets were to be obeyed. Their examples were to be followed. It required a very high degree of respect and prestige in the eyes of the would-be followers. But could a prophet command a genuine respect if his own character was not without blemish? How could his community believe that his claim of prophethood was based on truth? After all, a man who had committed sins in past could again commit another sin, that of false pretension. So, to carry on the work of God, the prophets must have been sinless and free from mistakes. This capability to refrain from sins is called ismat in Islam, and the Muslims accept that all the prophets were sinless. Of course, some stories are told about some of the prophets which are not edifying, to say the least. But we know how the passage of time starts legends about historical personalities and how human mind works out the details and how every generation wants to justify its own morality, perverted or otherwise, by pretending that it is what was done by more wise men, in this case, the prophets. As a result of this mental exercise, the followers succeeded in creating a not very lovely picture of their prophets just to satisfy their own troubled conscience. Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was an excerpt from the book Inner Voice by Allama Sayyid Said Akhtar Rizvi. Our website is parstoday.com. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
Since the rise of Mohammed bin Salman as the de facto leader, the country has embarked on a senseless kind of adventurism across the region. The young prince's aggressive performance in the theater of politics has almost backfired, exposing the kingdom to retaliatory responses from other regional actors. The result has been embarrassing for a country that considered itself as the leader of the Arab world, and apparently the main supporter of the Palestinian nation. In order to protect its own soil against its newly unnecessarily made enemies, the Saudis are now seeking to purchase missile systems from Palestine's number one enemy, namely the Israeli regime. One of the major importers of arms, and at the same time as a country with one of the weakest armies in the world, Saudi Arabia is now keen on having Israel's Iron Dome. According to Breaking Defense, Riyadh is considered considering Israeli-made missile systems seriously as never before. The timing is, of course, of considerable significance, as the Saudis have sought to procure the Iron Dome for a few years, but this time, their interest has reached a very practical phase. This level of military interaction cannot happen overnight. That's why Saudi Arabia and the Israeli regime don't have formal relations with each other. In the Muslim world, the Saudis are accused of having intelligence cooperation, at least for some years, with the Israelis, and the Iron Dome purchase might act as corroborative evidence.
Now, according to sources, the Saudi interest in the Israeli Iron Dome has reached a practical phase, and this in many ways can be seen as representative of the overall alliance between the two regimes, which hasn't been made public yet, but apparently there have been talks between the two regimes for years, including on this so-called security and defense issue, as they call it. So it would not be, it doesn't really come as a surprise, given that there has been an increasing diplomatic as well as a military, at least from an ideological point of view, harmonization between the two regimes.
In the absence of American Thaad and Patriot batteries, which recently were removed from Prince Sultan Amir base, the Saudis are scrambling to find new missile systems. But experts believe the situation is much more complicated, with the odds heavily against the kingdom.
The United States has just in recent weeks removed its most advanced missile defense structure system from Saudi Arabia, and of course we should also see this within the context of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, which may have caused some nervous reactions among U.S. allies in the Gulf, including Saudi Arabia and its close allies there. And then of course at the same time there have been continuous responses from Yemen against Saudi Arabia in retaliation for its attacks on Yemen. So the Saudi regime is confronted with challenges, but trying to keep its quite a powerful position through new configurations.
In recent months, Ansarullah has dealt great blows to the Saudi-led coalition forces after years of bombing and targeting Yemeni civilians and infrastructure. The Saudis have found themselves vulnerable against Yemen's homemade drones. And disappointed by what the kingdom is in position of, Saudi Arabia is going to try its luck this time with Israeli missile systems. Those systems already tested and of course failed against retaliatory attacks from Gaza. In other words, like the American Patriot missile systems, the Israeli Iron Dome system's combat performance has grossly been exaggerated. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has always asserted that it would help the enemies of Iran, particularly in terms of intelligence and military equipment. Helping the Saudis against Yemen's Ansarullah, who have launched successful retaliatory attacks against Saudi targets, and trying to back the kingdom up in the face of the Islamic Republic of Iran, just one side of the coin. The other side is without doubt marketing and milking a rich customer such as Saudi Arabia. And the embarrassing point is Riyadh's plan to obtain equipment from a regime it is supposed to be at loggerheads with.
The Israeli regime has, of course, been marketing its military equipment and technologies, including surveillance technologies internationally that it has tested on Palestinians for many years. That includes different mechanisms for the perpetuation of state violence that are presented as defense and security. And it has provided oppressive regimes all over the world with different sorts of methods to facilitate human rights violations, surveillance, and the control and containment of different populations, in particular minority populations. So the Saudi regime would be just one of many oppressive regimes that is actually buying technology from the Israeli regime for so-called security and defense purposes.
News of the procurement of the Iron Dome comes a few years after denials by both Riyadh and Tel Aviv. According to the Israeli news outlet Haaretz, the Saudis, as well as its allies, including the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, sought to buy the Iron Dome for the second time in September 2019. Now the procurement is by and large being interpreted as a prelude to the normalization, or as some critics put it, the publicization of relations between the two sides.
So these latest developments could definitely be another prelude to the normalization or to the publicization of the relations between the Saudi and the Israeli regime. So there has been a normalization, so-called, to some extent, and it needs to be seen when and how an official publicization would take place, but Saudi has, of course, backed the normalization between the Zionist entity and the dictatorships in Bahrain and UAE that took place in 2020, and the Saudi and Israeli regimes have been collaborating and doing that more and more openly in recent years, and have on numerous occasions actually expressed their solidarity with one another.
Yoel Vazansky from Tel Aviv University's Institute for National Security Studies, INSS, has recently pointed out Israel would do the right thing by offering the Saudi kingdom assistance in defending its strategic facilities against a growing threat from Iran. All in all, this is not a surprising development going on between the Saudi kingdom and the Israeli regime. The ugly alliance between the two sides has been built upon confronting popular demands, including freedom and democracy, across the region, and in particular in both Saudi Arabia and the occupied territories.
Of course, Israel is a very useful ally here, and not to forget, of course, that these regimes, Saudi, Israel, and other U.S. proxies, have their existence as oppressive regimes which are embedded in Western framework, guaranteed to a large extent of their transactional relation with the United States. So obviously they would, to that extent, collaborate amongst each other.
As two destabilizing forces in the region, the chemistry between the two sides is to some extent based on the oppression-destruction strategy and a need for constant militarization as a result of that. The Saudis have been attacking their neighboring Muslim country for the past few years, the first heinous sin, and then asking for help from another Muslim nation's enemy, the second unforgivable sin, while calling itself the leader of the Muslim world. The anti-Iranian rhetoric provides the two sides with a pretext to justify their alliance, what was hard to even imagine a decade ago.
IRIB English Radio.